Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Legend of Takhti.
He was the best wrestler in Iranian history.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service.
Rumors spread that
he had been killed.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and here is what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. Concerns over food safety in Zambia after aflatoxins were found in maize.
There's a very big concern, as you know, we depend on this type of crop, and anything that threatens that particular crop threatens the economic part of it. It also risks our trade relationships with other neighboring countries.
And in South Africa, shock as the Economic Freedom Fighters Party deputy leader exits. Who is he and what did he do for the party?
Floyd has been deputy to Malema for more than 10 years. He had ambitions to become the president of the EFF, and there were no indications that Julius Malema was about to leave anytime soon. So he got tired. He wanted power.
It's Tuesday, the 27th of August. First, we go to Burkina Faso. The country has been battling Islamist insurgency for several years. About half of the country is said to be currently outside of the control of a military-led government, which seized power in 2022. At the time, the junta argued that the deposed government and the French troops deployed in the country had done little to tackle the jihadist groups linked to Al-Qaeda and the so-called Islamic State. The French troops have since been kicked out and ties with Russia strengthened. However, cases of insecurity have been on the rise even with the junta in power. An attack of the weekend in the northern part of the country is reported to have killed over 200 security officers and civilians. In a rare move, the junta has acknowledged the attack, which an Al-Qaeda-linked group claimed responsibility for. To put this in perspective, here is Helen Abatoni Mzungu, a global security analyst who specializes in sub-Saharan Africa at the Risk Assistance Network Exchange.
The people and the junta itself are still in shock. There's still heightened security presence in Barcelogo, where the attack took place. And there have been visits by junta officials to residents who were affected by the attack. So the attack has now been claimed by Al-Qaeda affiliate Jenim, which killed at least 200 people, including civilians, security forces and pro-government militias.
Talk to us about this Al-Qaeda affiliate group that conducted this attack. Who are they?
So JNIM is a coalition of Al-Qaeda-linked groups, which started in Mali in 2017 and spread to Niger and Burkina Faso. Its primary objectives are to expand influence across the Sahel and possibly beyond, as we've been seeing in recent years, destabilize local governments and drive out Western forces, particularly the French and UN peacekeeping missions, which so far has been done by the juntas. They also aim to position themselves as protectors of local population to gain support, which they are doing well in areas like Central Mopti.
So Helen, that sounds quite interesting, because in the context of Burkina Faso, when the military junta took over in 2022, they said they wanted to do something very similar. They said the government had failed to protect local populations from attacks. They said they wanted to drive out foreign influence, particularly from the French and other Western allies. Why do these missions sound so similar, yet being executed in very horrible ways where people die?
There are various reasons to why the junta is failing at protecting the population. Particularly in Burkina Faso, the junta has put in place very harsh counterterrorism strategies, such as forced conscription, coupled with inadequate equipping of pro-government militias and security forces themselves, leading to high casualty rates, further driving recruitment for jihadist groups. Secondly, abuses by security forces have also fueled jihadist recruitment by exploiting local grievances and expanding their influence geographically. And finally, the lack of air power and equipment from the departure of French and other Western allies means that there has been increased jihadist mobility, allowing them to mobilize in larger numbers and carry out frequent large-scale attacks that we are seeing today.
So how many militant groups we are seeing operating in Burkina Faso, because about half of the country seems to be outside the control of the military government there. How many other groups are there, and who are they linked to in the sense of the globally known Islamic or even terrorist groups?
There are two main ones, one of them being JNIM that I explained earlier, and the second one being Islamic State group, which is known locally as Islamic State Sahel province. So the Islamic State Sahel province, they also aim to establish a caliphate and impose their strict interpretation of Islam while expanding control over territories, particularly through violent attacks and targeting of state authorities. So since losing its strongholds in the Middle East in 2019, the Islamic State shifted its propaganda to focus on expansion in sub-Saharan Africa, where it has five branches, including the Sahel one.
Just elaborate further on that point, in the sense that how do these militant groups like Al-Qaeda and Islamic State, IS, differ, and what are their links to the different African countries?
Interestingly, in the terms of similarities, both groups are competing for influence, resources and recruits in the Sahel, leading to clashes between their fighters, but while also contributing to the widespread of instability in the region. So IS is the one that most connected to other groups on the continent. We have them in Mozambique. There's the Allied Democratic Forces in Eastern DR Congo that claim affiliation to the Islamic State in Somalia, and also the Sahel province that I just mentioned. So while coordination between these groups is not at times very obvious, but they contribute to the global agenda in terms of attacks, scale of attacks, and tactics that they use.
You mentioned earlier, Helen, that the military junta in Burkina Faso could be failing in terms of its protection mandate to the civilian population. Why are they failing, and could it be the reason we are seeing an increase in attacks? Because just in June, there was another quite deadly attack as well.
One of the main reasons that they're failing is lack of capabilities. This is driven by the poverty levels that Burkina Faso faces, the isolation that it's facing as part of the implications of the coups that we saw in 2022. But we also saw a huge reallocation of security resources following the coup, where the junta shifted personnel and equipment from jihadist hotspots to protect the capital, creating vulnerabilities in other areas.
The difference this time is we've seen the army officials acknowledge this attack. You mentioned that they had visited the population that was affected by this. Why are they doing this now, given that in the past they have not been at the forefront of acknowledging these attacks?
Acknowledging a large-scale attack like this one is part of a strategy to show the population that they understand what is happening and that doing all that they can to protect the population from the enemy, who are the jihadists. But this is mainly for them to avoid backlash from the population and potential protests. Acknowledging some attacks while downplaying others allows the junta to control the narrative. They may avoid reporting some attacks to prevent the perception that they're losing control over the security situation.
So Burkina Faso itself has topped the recent Norwegian Refugee Council NRC list of world's most neglected displacement crisis. How badly is the insecurity in the country affecting the people there?
50 to 60% of the country is not under government control. We're talking about dire socioeconomic challenges. And just quickly, according to the Global Terrorism Index, nearly 2,000 people were killed in 258 attacks in Burkina Faso last year. And this accounts for a quarter of all terrorist deaths globally and up 68% from the previous year. So this means there's mass displacement from attacks, with over 2 million people displaced internally. There's no access to basic services such as food, education, as schools are closed, and no or limited access to healthcare.
Helen, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Helen Abatoni Mzungu, a global security analyst at the Risk Assistance Network Exchange, RAIN. To Zambia now, where the country is facing a serious issue with aflatoxins in maize. Dozens of dogs have reportedly died after eating contaminated food, raising concerns about potential risks to people. Tests found that about half of the samples from grain milling companies contained high levels of the toxins, which can cause liver cancer, according to the World Health Organization. The government has asked the companies to recall the affected products from the market to avoid further consumption. Now, maize is a staple food in Zambia, making this a major public health concern, and authorities are investigating the nation's grain supply following these alarming findings. Eric Kalima is an agronomist and has been explaining to me what aflatoxins are and how damaging they can be to both humans and animals.
To drill in on what aflatoxins are, these are just simply a very natural occurring toxins that you'll find in different grains that we consume. But these aflatoxins are produced by certain molds, which are very specific, as certain pathogens that contribute to that. So when you're growing a certain crop in your field, depending on the temperature fluctuations, you may have high, low temperatures, wet, humid environments. Those conditions, they normally tend to bring in the production of these molds that tend to be in the field. Sometimes they will cling to the crop or the grains, harvesting during production, even during storage times. You can have these toxins being produced, especially after the molds have developed.
So the molds are developed and they happen to have these aflatoxins. Why are these toxins dangerous for consumption by human beings and animals?
These aflatoxins are quite dangerous because they are chemical compounds that have got the potential of causing cancer. And these are permissible levels of these toxins that can be consumed by a human beings, even animals. But apparently, for your own information, human beings metabolize or tolerate these toxins better than animals such as dogs. So you find that the levels that are permissible for human beings are slightly higher as compared to the animals such as dogs and the rest. This is what happens because of that concern about the cancer-causing part. These aflatoxins should not be taken in excess or any prolonged exposure to these toxins. They can cause other effects that can affect both animal health and human health.
So help us then understand how the aflatoxins come about. You did mention about pathogens growing in the fields and things like that. Is it just about maize in the field, or is it about how it's harvested, how it's stored, and processes like that?
It's not only about maize, how it is grown and processed in the field. It's beyond. Even other crops such as peanuts, cotton seed, tree nuts, talk of macadamias, pecans, they also get these toxins. Now, how do they get contaminated? We are looking at the field contamination during the production time. When somebody is growing this particular crop, if at all they introduce this particular grain or seed of maize in the field that is already contaminated, at that point, they are also exposing that particular seed to grow up together with that particular pathogen that is going to cause these aflatoxins because of the molds that will develop. So away from the production times, we're looking at also how do they store these grains once they are in the storage sheds. The storage also is a big concern. If it is not well ventilated, you are building up the humidity in that storage shed. The temperature is quite high. Ventilation is compromised. Again, you are making the environment conducive for these molds to start producing these toxins via these pathogens.
Right. So help us then understand the latest news, really. How big is or how widespread is the contamination that we are talking about right now? And
Have there been sort of tests that have been done on maize, the grains available in the market now, to determine the extent of this contamination?
The tests have been done. We know the authorities are giving us updates. Yesterday, we had the director from the Ministry of Livestock and Fisheries talking about what the government has done so far that are responsible for looking after the welfare of both animal side and the human side. So what they've done, the extent to which this has affected the country is that we've heard initially the number was around 400 dogs that had died. But from what we have been told now, it's 99 dogs that succumbed across the country. I've seen the pattern, which is quite strange. It's normally along the Rhine of Leo, and the people in the rural areas, mainly, they are not affected by this pattern. So more tests have been conducted. Of course, they did some tests, but they got feather samples that they sent to South Africa for confirmation, just to make sure that what they were suspecting is truly the case that they are trying to fight. So that is what the government have done so far.
And is there a concern across the country as well, especially among the members of the public? Because maize is a staple food in Zambia, and Zambia is actually a large producer of maize, selling to other countries as well in the region.
There's a very big concern. As you know, we depend on this type of crop. And anything that threatens that particular crop threatens the economic part of it. It also risks our trade relationships with other neighboring countries. The more reason why we have seen that the government is now trying to come in and intervene and making sure that everything possible is being done to abate this situation, which has raised a lot of dust in the past 1 week or so.
Okay, I noticed something you said, that people in the villages, rural areas are not quite affected by this. Got me wondering, because majority of the food they consume is not processed. It's not gone through the usual value chain of getting into factories and being put in shelves. And are we seeing any response from milling companies and food producers in the country responding to what's happening now?
We've seen the response from the food processors and the millers as well. They've recalled some batches. Last week, there was a very huge exercise that was done by the regulatory authorities where a number of bags of maize were destroyed that were found with aflatoxins beyond the permissible levels. So the state moved in and made sure that those did not find themselves with the consumers. So there are certain batches that have been recalled off the market, and to recall, it's not an easy exercise, but I'm glad that the government have come in also to try to work with these millers to make sure that they identify the dealers that they work with and communicate to them not to sell those batches to consumers because of what they have found in those particular batches that could be threatening to both animal and human health.
And finally, then, how can Zambia avoid a situation like this in the future? Is there a way to prevent the contamination of food with aflatoxins?
Yes, there's something that should be done, not only Zambia, like you have put it, globally or Africa. Kitonga, you know that we have this animal that has been dreaded by a number of countries, which we are calling climate change. That is causing huge fluctuations in terms of temperatures. We're experiencing warm, humid temperatures. Sometimes it's too much rainfall, floods that are coming in, and we need to prepare adequately for such kind of eventualities as a country. First of all, farmers, food safety should be the number one. Whatever that we are handling, there should be deliberate measures that should be put in on how to handle this food safety, starting from the farmers. Those people that are using and harvesting mechanically, how are they doing it? Are we not seeing damages on the kennels? Because if they've done damages on the kennels and the moisture is high enough for the mold to form, just know that we are fostering the development of these molds, and production of these toxins by these pathogens will be exacerbated. Away from that, the inspection of storage facilities has to be enhanced. Even from the miller side, the food processors for both animals and humans, there should be a deliberate measure where these storage facilities has to be inspected regularly. And people will be handling that. They have to be trained and equipped with enough knowledge, because that is important. This is a big wake-up call that we can diversify and introduce other crops that probably we can depend on. In cases and times like this, this should not be a barrier or should be a reason for people to starve to death. This should give us an opportunity to look at other crops also that we can grow and produce to make sure that human health and animal health are protected.
Eric Kalima, an agronomist in Zambia. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right? Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather, and there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened, not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.
And now to South Africa. The aftershocks from last May's election continue to reverberate. The ruling African National Congress, ANC, lost its parliamentary majority for the first time in 30 years. This was after the ANC lost votes to a new party of former President Jacob Zuma, Umkhonto we Sizwe Party, or MK Party. The country now has a government of national unity. Last week, the spotlight turned to the Economic Freedom Fighters Party, EFF. Its foundations were shaken after the deputy leader Floyd Shivambu defected to MK. In this year's election, the EFF suffered a major setback when instead of becoming the country's second largest party, it dropped to fourth. Mr. Shivambu has long been seen as the EFF's ideological guru behind the fiery Julius Malema. So what does this development mean for the EFF, Julius Malema, and South African politics? I've been speaking to a leading commentator on South African politics, Prince Mashele. He is the executive director of the Center for Politics and Research. Let's start with you, explaining to us who Floyd Shivambu is. For people not in South Africa, people that may not have heard of him, who is he?
Floyd Shivambu is a relatively young politician in his early 40s. He is a prominent figure in South African politics. Historically, he came from the African National Congress. He was groomed in the ANC Youth League. He worked with a firebrand that is well known in South Africa, Julius Malema. They have been personal friends working together in the ANC Youth League. Julius Malema was expelled from the ANC Youth League back in 2012, and he went on together with his friend Floyd Shivambu to form a very radical leftist political organization called the Economic Freedom Fighters. Floyd Shivambu became the deputy president and Malema became president. So over 10 years, they actually radicalized South African politics, mainly appealing to the unemployed youth who felt that they had lost out of democracy. And recently they had a massive fallout and Floyd Shivambu left the Economic Freedom Fighters.
Yeah. And why did he leave? What's at the center of that fallout?
Floyd has been, as I said, deputy to Malema for more than 10 years. He had ambitions to become the president of the EFF, and there were no indications that Julius Malema was about to leave anytime soon. So he got tired of becoming the deputy to his old friend. He wanted power. Number two, in the recent times in South Africa, as you know, a government of national unity has been formed. And the two of them, that is Floyd and Julius, had differences as to the participation of the EFF in the government of national unity. And these differences widened their personal rift. And Floyd Shivambu eventually decided that he must leave the EFF. And it looks to me that he didn't only want to leave, but he wanted to destabilize the EFF.
The thing is, the EFF also came fourth in the elections in May, which was quite unexpected because they were beaten by Jacob Zuma's, the former president party, MK, which was a very young party formed towards the end of last year. Are they losing influence, and could that be part of the reason why, you know, the leadership is not holding together?
This was for the first time since they were formed 11 years ago that they actually experienced an electoral decline. This could partly explain why Flo Chiwambu left, because he can see that the EFF is now moving in reverse electorally. And when he looked on the other side, he realized that Jacob Zuma's new party, Umkhonto we Sizwe, which was formed hardly 8 months ago, grew and became the third largest party in South Africa. So he may also be seeing political fortunes in MK and hoping that he is going to be prominent and that he can use the MK to actually be a leader of South Africa one day.
Now he's found a new home, Mr. Chiwambu, in President Zuma's party. What does it say about, you know, the comeback of Jacob Zuma in the South African politics? Because not only did they become third in the election, now he's getting some influential figures from one of the key competitors in the South African politics.
It means Jacob Zuma is a formidable figure in South African politics. But it does not mean that Jacob Zuma has a future in South African politics, because he's very old. He's 83 years old now, and he has already served as South Africa's president. The courts have already ruled that he cannot go to parliament, given that he has a criminal record. So he doesn't have a future in South African politics, but he is actually a current destabilizer today in South Africa. So the hope is that those leaders, young leaders who are gravitating towards this party, that they will grow the party and be influential in the future. I doubt if that will happen, because the main glue holding together the party is actually Jacob Zuma himself. The day he departs from politics, I think that the party will fall apart.
And what does this then, the issues, you know, in EFF, what do they mean for the whole opposition outfit in South Africa? Because there was a government of national unity not long ago. The smaller parties were left out or probably didn't want to join. Are they, given the issues now, are they able to challenge the government properly in South Africa and play their role in opposition, given the issues that we are seeing internally in the EFF?
The EFF is now a very weak party, and as a result, it will be unable to exert political force to challenge the government of national unity. I think that a party that is going to shake the political tree in South Africa is Umkhonto we Sizwe, not the EFF. The EFF is actually a limping party that must fight for its political survival. It has to concentrate on itself. It cannot concentrate on shaking the political tree in the wider South Africa.
People must be wondering whether we could be seeing the beginning of the end of EFF and its influence in the South African politics, because I'm assuming Mr. Chiwambu must have had friends and people loyal to him within the party, being a deputy party leader, which is a huge position. Are we likely to see more movements, people migrating from that party and joining the MK or even any other parties within the South African political sphere?
The president of the EFF, Julius Malema, did say that he is aware of other leaders of the EFF who are going to leave and follow Floyd Chiwambu. And the expectations is that the party will lose more members and leaders.
Prince Mashele there in South Africa. Focus on Africa was produced by Bella Hassan and Yvette Togira Maria in London. Susan Gashohi was in Nairobi. Patricia Whitehorn was in charge, and Johnny Hall was the technical producer. Our editors are Andre Lombard and Alice Muthengi. I'm Charles Gitonga. We'll speak again next time.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right? Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather, and there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened, not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.